So if anyone has any vision trouble whatsoever, please come right up the front as close as you wish. Water. So what I'll do with the format, I'll just go through reasonably slowly, and I'll stop maybe every two or three paragraphs. And if anyone has got a point that they want to make or a view or an opinion, just please indicate. Just put your hand up. I've got my reading glasses on, but I should be able to spot you. And what I'll do is I'll have you guys give your input first, and then I'll add anything which is left over, anything I've sort of picked up along the way. So, thus have I heard, once the Lord was staying at Rajagaha on the mountain called Vulture's Peak. Now just then King Ajatasattu, Vediputta of Magadha, wanted to attack the Vajjayans. He said, I will strike the Vajjayans who are so powerful and strong. I will cut them off and destroy them. I will bring them to ruin and destruction. And King Ajatasattu said to his chief minister, the Brahmin Vasaka, Brahmin, go to the Blessed One, worship him with your head to his feet in my name. Ask if he is free from sickness or disease, if he is living at ease, vigorously and comfortably, and then say, Lord, King Ajatasattu, Vediputta of Magadha, wishes to attack the Vajjayans and say, I will strike the Vajjayans, bring them to ruin and destruction, and whatever the Lord declares to you, report that faithfully back to me, for Tathagatas never lie. It's quite an interesting point, because later, when the Ajatasattu's senior minister went to the Buddha basically explained to him the process where he could have essentially brought about the disbandment of the Wajirian, political and military process. Because previously he had difficulty overcoming the Vajjayan empire, and it was only when that particular minister went to see the Buddha, and the Buddha went over the key points, he gave him the information which led to the downfall of the Vajjayans. Very good, sir, said Vasaka, and having had the state carriages harnessed, he mounted one of them and drove in state from Rajagaha to Vulture's Peak, riding as far as the ground would allow. Then continuing on foot to where the Lord was, he exchanged courtesies with the Lord, and then sat down to one side and delivered the king's message. And as many of you are aware, that King Ajatasattu was the nephew of King Pasenadi of Kosala, and Ajatasattu was famous for that act of parricide, bringing about the death of his father in order to essentially take hold of the throne. Now, the Venerable Ananda was standing behind the fan, fanning him, and the Lord said, Ananda, have you heard that the Vajjayans hold regular and frequent assemblies? I have heard, Lord, that they do. Ananda, as long as the Vajjayans hold regular and frequent assemblies, they may be expected to prosper and not to decline. Have you heard that the Vajjayans meet in harmony, break up in harmony, and carry on their business in harmony? I have heard, Lord, that they do. Ananda, as long as the Vajjayans meet in harmony, break up in harmony, and carry on their business in harmony, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. Have you heard that the Vajjins do not authorize what has not been authorized already, and do not abolish what has been authorized, but proceed according to what has been authorized by their ancient tradition? I have, Lord. Have you heard that they honor, respect, revere, and salute the elders among them, and consider them worth listening to, and that they do not forcibly abduct other wives and daughters and compel them to live with them, that they honor, respect, revere, and salute the Vajjin shrines at home and abroad, not withdrawing the proper support made and given before, that proper provision is made for the safety of Arahants, so that Arahants may come in future to live there, and that those already there may dwell in comfort. I have, Lord. So many of these principles are actually laid down for the monastic sangha as well, you know, both on the nuns and the monks' side. But you know, you do have you have these like core principles, but you still have the underlying structure that the senior monk or the abbot lays down for the dynamics in the monastery, because you'll find that there are many, I mean, very, very solid forest monasteries, practice monasteries in, say, Thailand or Burma, where they, you know, they don't insist on, regular meetings. They may, the senior teacher may only call a meeting possibly even just once a week, or if there's any kind of major issues, you know, maybe a second meeting to discuss, could be community business or core wild or, you know, vineyard rules or this kind of thing. So, with some, I've been in a monastery where there was like something like a dozen meetings, almost covering all sorts of different aspects of the community, the committee, the work scene, and like heart meetings and all this kind of thing. But sometimes it can be a sense of overkill, because you know, if you're living, you know, you're living in a Buddhist community as a monastic, and you're trying to develop yourself not only for the good of oneself, but for the good of others as well. But you may find that, you know, constantly having been pulled in and engaging in community meetings, or maybe one meeting almost every single day, plus a morning and evening meeting, might be a little bit too much for some people, because you don't really get a lot of time to yourself. You don't get much seclusion and the ability to work on one's meditation practice, and you find that with both the monks and the nuns, and even the long-term lay disciples, say living in, especially in Asia, long-term in Asian communities, if they can't hold the meditation together on for whatever reason, that essentially, you know, once the quality of the practice falls away and the defilements actually take hold of the mind, then essentially you may be walking a thin line, and you may possibly leave that community at some point. Because the bottom line is that, you know, even if you were dying, say for example you were just completely riddled with cancer, It's much better to die, you know, in the monastery with your friends than to actually die in the hospital amongst strangers. You know, it's a sort of common understanding within the forest fraternity. As long as you can get, you know, pain, you know, you can get reasonable pain relief, you're reasonably comfortable, regardless of whatever sickness, disease, process, you know, you're far better off, you know, actually dying within the community setting than dying, you know, maybe in some general hospital system with people who don't know you and don't really understand you whatsoever. Ananda, so long as such proper provision is made, the Vajjins may be expected to prosper and not decline. Then the Lord said to the Brahmin Vasaka, once Brahmin, when I was at the Sarandada shrine in Vasali, I taught the Vajjins these seven principles for preventing decline, and as long as they keep to these seven principles, these principles remain in force, the Vajjins may be expected to prosper and not decline. At this, Vasaka replied, "Venerable Gotama, if the Vajjayans keep to even one of these principles, they may be expected to prosper and not decline, far less all seven. Certainly the Vajjayans will never be conquered by King Ajatasattu by force of arms, but only by means of propaganda and setting them against one another. And now, Reverend Gotama, may I depart? I am busy and have much to do. Brahman, do as you think fit." Then Vasaka, rejoicing and delighting at the Lord's words, rose from his seat and departed. So, yeah, that particular principle of, say, propaganda, something, you know, you might commonly see in the world, you know, say within the political arena, and especially in politics, and maybe within the military to a degree, and sometimes even in business, big business, large companies, where you may have one individual or a group of individuals who want to potentially seize power, authority, and control, and you know, with those kind of dynamics, that, you know, when you think that kind of perspective approach, you know, wanting to secure you know, power, especially, you know, and authority for oneself, now that type of self-aggrandization where you feel, you know, your ego feels quite strong, you feel very important, you know, you can make things happen, you can basically have people assassinated or sort of got rid of in a sense, and so, you know, but unfortunately that kind of approach, when you look at it on a karmic level, that, you know, very, very few of those kind of individuals who follow that kind of path to secure the goals that they wish to achieve, they're not able to maintain their power base, you know, usually not even for, say, like a potentially, in all, when you look right across the range, not necessarily for, say, like a full life term. There are exceptions, you know, you can have, say like dynasties, you know, say like Korea, North Korea. We had a Korean monk in the monastery, and I asked him why. You know, when you've got a situation where the North Koreans are basically they're impoverished, disadvantaged, you know, economically deprived. I think things are changing in Korea, from what I've heard. But, you know, the economic conditions for working class people is quite, you know, it's quite, so quite unsatisfactory. And, you know, especially for poor people, you know, they're very, very disadvantaged. And I said, how does the government, you know, maintain such a strong hold over the nation, over the people, over the political and military dynamics? And his answer was that the current government, the royal family, essentially they are part of a dynasty which has been repeating itself for about 500 years, I think he mentioned, and I don't know the exact time frame. And so the family's been able to maintain such a very, very strong hold over the dynamics within the country. But you basically in order to maintain your power base, you've got to essentially you've got to be able to keep the political leaders, the military leaders and commanders inside, and control the economics of the country, and then you may be able to enforce your authority and law, but that kind of approach makes you a lot of enemies. It disadvantages a lot of people. And eventually that kind of karmic approach will come full circle, and you will be deposed from power. Because when you look at this kind of psychological structure, this kind of approach with leaders who basically take charge of a country or a nation, that when you use an approach which is more sort of humanistic, which is more, say, socialistic in a sense. And, you know, you have principles of where you share wealth, you know, the wealth of the nation, the material wealth, and you provide services, you know, like healthcare and looking after the poor, you know, things like protecting single mothers and orphans and a social structure which actually supports and protects its citizens. And, you know, you minimise the level of corruption within the government and the military, and you get a more even and fair system of government. And that will be, in the long term, the tendency is that kind of systematic approach will be more successful and more enduring in the long term, because when you approach it from an unwholesome perspective, that the karmic effect, you know, it comes like full circle, and it creates, you know, people, they may be able to establish a degree of power and authority, but they may have to use, I mean, quite a significant degree of force to maintain their grip, because they essentially, that kind of approach, they disadvantage, you know, many, many people, probably, you know, the majority of the population. So 1.6, soon after Vasakha had gone, the Lord said, Ananda, go to whatever monks there are around Rajagaha and summon them to the assembly hall. Very good, Lord, said Ananda, and did so. Then he came to the Lord, saluted him, stood to one side and said, Lord, the order of monks is assembled. Now is the time for the Lord to do as he sees fit. Then the Lord rose from his seat, went to the assembly hall, sat down on the prepared seat and said, monks, I will teach you 7 things that are conducive to welfare. Listen, pay careful attention and I will speak. Yes, Lord, said the monks, and the Lord said this. So that particular word, welfare, I mean, you essentially, it's a fairly broad term that they with the translation, but in a, it's still applicable in the sense that you can apply that sense of welfare almost right across the board within a social setting. So whatever level of society, whatever the dynamics are, if you move towards a system of say wealth, you know, say welfare, fairness and social support, that will essentially, it will support the structure that the economic, political, military structure which is in place at that time. Listen, pay careful attention, I will speak. Yes, Lord, said the monks, and the Lord said this. As long as the monks hold regular and frequent assemblies, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. As long as they meet in harmony, break up in harmony, and carry on their business in harmony, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. As long as they do not authorize what has not been authorized already, and do not abolish what has been authorized, but proceed according to what has been authorized by the rules of training. So many of you are familiar, you would have come across that sutta where the Buddha gave invitation to the monks. This is when he was coming towards the very end of his life. Those last few moments, he gave the monks invitation to, you know, give them the opportunity to essentially renounce the minor and lesser rules, which is for example, the tulachayas, and pachityas, you know, down to the very, very small rules. And so, but essentially, by allowing the monks to, say, like, relinquish virtually easily, like maybe 3/4, maybe slightly less than 3/4 of the 227 standard rules that the monks have, you can actually put the monastic community at as a disadvantage, because when you have the full rule structure, which is established by the Buddha, and each rule, as incidents or infractions actually came up in the community, then the Buddha would convene a meeting and lay down a training rule for the essentially for the discipline and the harmony of the community. So if you had say interpersonal difficulties between the monastics, or the lay community weren't happy with the way that the monastics were behaving or conducting themselves, or you can even be just like business dynamics. I mean, somebody was talking to me about a senior monk from Thailand who had to, I know both these monks, and one senior monk went to drop in on a junior, and it wasn't a very, very heavy issue, but it gave me the impression it was in relation with the money rule, and you know, especially in Thailand, Burma, essentially the monks in the forest tradition, they really have to keep that rule quite closely, because if the monks don't keep the money rule, you know, they don't handle and use money, then you know you essentially don't get the problems and difficulties and the greed and the corruptive element which actually comes with using cash, because there's a couple of principles where if the, you know, because the monks are supposed to be based in living a reasonably simple lifestyle, a minimum level of renunciation, and to be easy to support, that, you know, as soon as the monastics start using money, then you move back towards the status of a lay person, because you conduct yourself in a way which lay people just normally do on a day to day basis with their the life that they especially with their working life, family life. You know, you have to use money to survive and cover one's needs. As long as they honour, respect, revere and salute the elders of long standing who are long ordained fathers and leaders of the order, as long as they do not fall prey to desires which arise in them and lead to rebirth, as long as they are devoted to forest lodgings, as long as they preserve their personal mindfulness so that in future the good among their companions will come to them and those who have already come will feel at ease with them, as long as the monks hold to these seven things and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So this business of respect, reverence and the salutation of older monastics, cuts the ice in the sense that, you know, essentially it's senior monks who are really largely responsible for the running of the community and sort of, you know, maintaining the training standard and the standard of etiquette and discipline and whatnot. And because the one lay disciple said to me, he said something like, the Buddha never gave. He said something along the lines of the Buddha never authorized that the abbot should really take full charge or control of the community. Giving the impression that whoever's at the top of the line essentially doesn't have the right to run or control the dynamics within the community. But the thing is that you really can't have the junior people essentially making the big decisions and being largely responsible for for discipline and for teaching, because the junior people don't really have the experience. You really need to be in robes for like 10 years before you really start to have a real feel for Dhamma, and you know the training rules, you know how to conduct yourself. You know, most people may have an ability to teach. You know, it all depends how much pressure, how much force you want to put in that area. You know, people have different kind of personalities, but essentially, you know, it's the senior people have the vast majority of the experience, you know, community experience, and essentially they really have to call the shots completely, but they may have to make the final decisions on certain issues, because the dynamics with the up at the monastery is when we have the monks meeting, if there's any points that are brought up or any relevant issues, that every single person in the line, so Ajahn Brahm gives his take, his opinion on a particular issue, and then it goes right down the line, down to the novices, so you get full input from the community, and you make, from that, we make an overall assessment. But when it comes down to the crunch, Ajahn Brahm essentially makes the final decision on crucial matters or matters which are, you know, of sort of quite reasonable significance, because, you know, he knows his lay fraternity quite well, you know, his network in Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, he's got his finger on many, many pulses, and he knows the dynamics, and the junior monks really they just don't have a clue at all. They may know exactly what they're doing within their own area, with the work projects, maybe the solar panels, plumbing, electrical, you know, this, that, and the other. But when it comes to the big picture, say the big the large support and the dynamics between the community, between the monastery and the external community, they really don't have like full awareness of exactly what's going on. I will tell you another seven things conducive to welfare. As long as monks and nuns do not rejoice, delight, and become absorbed in works, in chattering, in sleeping, in company, in evil desires, in mixing and associating with evil friends, as long as they do not rest content with partial achievements, as long as the monks hold to these seven things and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. Any opinions? So, yeah, this business, you know, as long as monks and nuns do not rejoice, delight, and become absorbed in works, but it can be a bit paradoxical, because if you don't have projects and buildings, you essentially and kutis, you don't have facilities for people to stay and practice. So you may have people who are very interested in ordaining and practicing in a particular setting. You may have a property, but essentially, you know, you've got to have a minimum level of infrastructure established. Otherwise, there's just nowhere to stay. You haven't got your main buildings, you know, kitchen, the meditation hall and kutis, and you know, with some monasteries it may take them at least 5 to 10 years just to even reach that particular point where you've got, you know, say like a minimum requirement as far as accommodation and facilities. And but unfortunately, especially in the West, it's much, you can simplify things, say like in Asia, you can build things in, you know, just like out of bamboo and straw, and you know, this type of thing. Very, very simple materials which are low cost. But in the West, because of the building standards, you know, the council forces you to adhere to really, really strict regulations, and that's when things get quite expensive. So, you know, the huts that we're building at Hermit's Hill that Ajahn Brahmani is largely responsible for, in conjunction with one of the junior monks who was a person who does drawing. What do they call these people who do drawings and plans? Yeah, architect within that category. And but the council they're so paranoid about basically mishaps, accidents, and a potential injury and death, that, you know, they force you to clear, you know, 30 meters around, say like a main building, maybe slightly less for a kuti, definitely less for a kuti, but then, you know, you've got to have double brick, you've got to have double, like windows with fireproof shutters, and, you know, the roof structure has to be a certain way, and it's got to basically, the kuti has got to be able to withstand a full frontal bushfire. You know, that's the level they want you to operate from. So this whole business, you know, like, especially with excessive socializing, you know, chatting, talking, sleeping in company, and mixing, associating with evil friends. So essentially, you know, you're just looking at one spends one's time unskillfully. So all of us, you know, during the course of a day, we could look at our day to day experience and think, well, you know, I mean, did I completely waste maybe 2 or 3 hours with a particular individual or activity, you know, or, you know, each person can actually sense it, you know, when we go through our daily dynamics. I mean, do the things that we do, are they a complete waste of time, or do we actually benefit in some way? And, Nick? Yeah. Word for it's essentially people with unwholesome tendencies. I mean, like evil might be. It's in a way, it's like a very general. The word has a very general sense to it, and I mean, like evil in what? But it. But essentially, if those people behave in a way which is completely unconducive to the path, then essentially that you shouldn't really associate with them, because, you know, their qualities, you know, you're going to be affected by their qualities, and if you spend too much time with them, they're going to rub off on you, you know. So, I mean, when I was in lay life, for some reason, I think it must be past karma, but I think it was probably my father as well to a degree, but I had an aversion to associating with heavy drinkers and drug addicts, even from a very, you know, even when I was in my teens, 15, 16, I just wouldn't hang out with these people, because I just had this perception that the, you know, these people just, you know, they I wouldn't call them like losers, but essentially they were just like just wasting their time. They ruined themselves both physically, psychologically, and financially. You know, I don't know anyone. I don't know any heavy drinker, or heroin or meth addict, who is even able to maintain a say like a satisfactory quality of life. You know, they get compromised on a number of levels. I will tell you another 7 things conducive to welfare. As long as monks continue with faith, with modesty, with fear of doing wrong, with learning, with aroused vigor, with established mindfulness, with wisdom. I will tell you another 7 things. As long as monks develop the enlightenment factor of mindfulness, of investigation of phenomena, of energy, of delight, of tranquility, of concentration, of equanimity. I will tell you another 7 things. As long as monks develop the perception of impermanence, of non-self, of impurity, of danger, of overcoming or dispassion or cessation, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. Monks, I will tell you 6 things that are conducive to communal living. As long as monks and nuns, both in public and private, show loving kindness to their fellows in acts of body, speech and thought, share with their virtuous fellows whatever they receive as a rightful gift, including the contents of their arms, which they do not keep to themselves. Ajahn Brahm's very generous like that. He always, even if things come his way or his personal requisites, he's quite more than happy to share his requisites with others. Like you could go into his kuti and take something from his cupboard, and as long as you let him know, he wouldn't mind whatsoever. Or even if you, like one of the monks, because we were renovating a kuti, one of the monks was in the Mahatera's room, Mahatera's kuti, which is right next to the store, and so he was disturbed at least 3 or 4 times a day by people going into the store. Even if they went in very quietly, the room was a bit of a sound chamber. So, and I said you could have really, you know, because Ajahn Brahm is not back till Wednesday, doesn't fly back till Wednesday. And I said, you could have moved into Ajahn Brahm's room. And, you know, and I know for a fact he would not have minded. You know, as long as the room was clean, tidy when he left, you know, he wouldn't have protested at all. But he felt it was wrong because he hadn't actually requested. But I didn't think it was such an incredible thing to ask. But it sort of ruined, you know, the last week of his retreat. Okay. Keep consistently unbroken and altered those rules of conduct that are spotless, leading to liberation. Praise by the wise, unstained and conducive to concentration, and persist therein with their fellows, both in public and in private. Continue in that noble view that leads to liberation, to the utter destruction of suffering, remaining in such awareness with their fellows, both in public and in private. As long as monks and nuns hold to these 6 principles and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. There's a lot of information. It might be a little bit hard to give personal views and opinions. But even if there's something, even if just any thought which comes up in your mind, anything which is not, maybe just, you know, of maybe an offshoot, it's still worth, might still be worth discussing. And then the Lord, while staying at Vulture's Peak, actually that whole list section, that number, that several paragraphs, essentially many of those principles they lie within the 37 enlightenment, you know, the fraternity of the 37 enlightenment factors. So you know you're looking at the you know the full course of training. And then the Lord, while staying at Vulture's Peak, gave a comprehensive discourse. This is morality, this is concentration, this is wisdom. Concentration, which is not the right word, when imbued with morality, brings great fruit and profit. Wisdom, when imbued with concentration, brings, it should be really stillness. Stillness brings great fruit and profit. The mind imbued with wisdom becomes completely free from the corruptions, and that is from the corruptions of sensuality, of becoming, of false views, and ignorance. And when the Lord had stayed at Rajagaha, as long as he wished, he said to the Venerable Ananda, "Come, Ananda, let us go to Ambalatika." "Very good, Lord," said Ananda, and the Lord went there with a large company of monks, which when they say a large company of monks, it usually means, say, like 500 plus. From previous sutta references. And the Lord stayed in the royal park at Ambalatika, and there he delivered a comprehensive discourse. This is morality, this is stillness, or we could say samadhi, in this context, samadhi. This is morality, this is samadhi, this is wisdom. So you're looking at the threefold training and the eightfold path is contained within. So morality, samadhi, wisdom is largely the whole of the path, and then the eightfold path of training is within those three major headings. Having stayed at Ambalatika as long as he wished, the Lord said to Ananda, "Let us go to Nalanda." And they did so. At Nalanda, the Lord stayed at Parawakika's mango grove. Then the Venerable Sariputta came to see the Lord, saluted him, sat down to one side and said, "It is clear to me, Lord, that there has never been, will be or is now another ascetic or Brahman who is better or more enlightened than the Lord. You have spoken boldly with the bull's voice, Sariputta. You have roared the lion's roar of certainty. How is this? Have all the Arahant Buddhas of the past appeared to you? And were the minds of all those lords open to you? So as to say, these lords were of such virtue, such was their teaching, such their wisdom, such their ways, such their liberation. No, Lord." And as many of you know, that Sariputta was the foremost of the Buddha's two chief disciples. Sariputta was the foremost in wisdom, very highly developed wisdom faculty, only second to the Buddha. And Venerable Mahamoggallana was the most proficient with psychic power, had a very, very high degree of mastery with different applications of psychic attainment, only secondary to the Buddha. And the Buddha, when you're talking about parami or qualities, this is like a commentarial. With parami, it's not a word you actually see in the suttas, but those qualities, it's based within the it comes from the scholar, the commentarial scholar fraternity, where they study the suttas and they draw on certain qualities, and then they essentially integrate and then give you, say, like a list of these core qualities that are imbued in the minds of these very say like highly developed people, but even a standard arahant that you might find possibly in Thailand or Burma, that the so-called paramita that you see in every one of these individuals, it's going to be at a certain level of proficiency, because you will have say like arahants who have incredible meditation and may have quite significant kindness and compassion for their fellow beings, but they may not necessarily have great ability as far as communication and teaching ability. Or you may have people who really, really project themselves very, very effectively as Dharma teachers, but their style is very, very, it could be very forceful, it can be very earthy, and might be, quite intense. It may not be the general population's cup of tea. It all depends on your mentality. Some people, they like these very, heavy duty teachers, because it rouses them, it really gets them up, gets them practicing. As Ajahn Brahm was saying, that especially in Thailand, because the Thais are quite relaxed, they're quite relaxed and easygoing, they like to have fun and they like to mix and socialize and this and that, and the monks have that cultural conditioning within them as well. If you're in a Thai monastery and you don't talk with the other monks, they might think that's sort of maybe a little bit on the antisocial side, even if you can't speak Thai that well. If you don't speak, you keep yourself isolated. They might find that maybe a little slightly disconcerting. So these very, very heavy duties that you see, especially coming from the more hardcore Thai forest tradition, it's because the cultural tendency is towards relaxation and ease, easygoing, getting along, this type of thing, that they deliberately rouse people, they shake them up, they use forceful tactics and a bit more pressure to get people practicing to the best
of their ability, you know, getting out there and walking, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours at a stretch, or putting in, you know, putting in absolute minimum 8 to 10 hours a day. You know, like Longpo Tui and Nong Khai, he would definitely be in the top 10 monasteries in Thailand as far as meditation and training monasteries. And, you know, he's had monks, you know, reasonable monks come to the monastery. They've requested to come stay, and they've come in the morning, and because he has such a very really, really pronounced mind reading ability, you know, I mean, those people would be on, you know, the afternoon bus, maybe back to where they came from, because, you know, he's only got to talk to someone for about 5 minutes and he's basically got them down. You know, he's got them worked out, and you can tell, you know, which people are sloppy, disciplined, you know, which people are just going to hang out and, you know, just cruise and whatnot. And he doesn't want people like that. You know, his young monks are like, essentially, they are like soldiers. They're like sort of like commandos, in a sense. They're very young, strong, you know, fast, smart, and disciplined young men. So very, very physical place. There's a lot of physical labor, you know, drawing water, carrying water, small projects. You know, they don't have, you know, it's not powered. They don't have many machines. You do everything by hand, and you get incredibly fit. You only need to be there for 4 weeks, and you know, you get yourself in shape in no time. Well then, Sariputta, you know me as the Arahant Buddha, and do you know the Lord is of such virtue, such is his teaching, such is his wisdom, such is his way, such is his liberation? No, Lord. So, Sariputta, you do not have knowledge of the minds of the Buddhas of the past, the future, or the present. Thus, Sariputta, have you not spoken boldly with the bull's voice and roared the lion's roar of certainty with your declaration? Lord, the minds of the Arahant Buddhas of the past, future, and present are not open to me, but I know the drift of the Dhamma. But I think at this time, I'm not sure of the attainment of Venerable Moggallana, of Venerable Sariputta at this Buddha's last days. Now, he was fully enlightened. Buddha's last days, he was definitely enlightened. Both of them were from memory. I don't know the exact how many years previously. It was only Ananda who was still a Sotapanna, you know, prior to the death of the Buddha. Lord, it's as if there was a royal frontier city with mighty bastions and a mighty encircling wall, in which there was a single gate at which was a gatekeeper, wise, skilled, and clever, who kept out strangers and let those in he knew. And he, constantly patrolling and following along a path, might not see the joins and clefts in the bastion, even such as a cat might creep through. But whatever large creatures entered or left the city must all go through this very gate. And it seems to me, Lord, that the drift of the Dhamma is the same. All those Arahant Buddhas of the past attained to supreme enlightenment by abandoning the 5 hindrances, defilements of mind that weaken the understanding, having firmly established the 4 foundations of mindfulness in their mind, and realized the 7 factors of enlightenment as they really are. So, you know, many of you are aware of this business with the 5 hindrances. You know, there's 5 main areas of, you could essentially call it emotional thought, which will stop you from getting the mind, you know, to a very, very, say, still state, and, you know, help you to bridge to the first jhana eventually. So, but the thing is that, because I checked this when I was in Thailand, but, you know, even if you have the 5 hindrances suppressed and you're at the level of say, firm upachara samadhi, that, you know, you can still attain sotapanna with that level of samadhi if you investigate in the correct manner. But, you know, and I asked one particular teacher, I said, what level of investigation are you talking about, the particular Thai teacher? And he said, if you go, he said, in essence, you really need to go internally. You need to go into the body, you know, the 32 parts. You need to go analysis of the four elements, mindfulness of death. You know, you really need to do the hard cookie practices. But you know, with that level of meditation, you can do that kind of practice for. You know, for many, many hours a day, and you won't get much difficulty from it, because the aversion, the defilements which give you aversion and maybe anger and irritation and whatnot, they just don't exist at the level of upachara samadhi. It's quite a, you know, the way they would describe it, it's a very, very still, quite pure state of mind, and those defilements just can't activate themselves. And they, you know, and even if you use these very forceful meditations, you can do it with ease. You could easily, you know, you can, once when you've got that level of energy and the sharpness of mind, you could probably investigate for hours in this kind of format each on a daily basis, and still be at ease. But in order to go right through to arahanthood, to power of the first jhana, and the Buddha said that in the suttas, and yeah, that was mentioned by a number of forest teachers. But it will take you a lot longer. If you're investigating in the correct manner, you know, the fourth jhana will give you essentially the mind is at its maximum level of power for investigation. So the person who has the fourth jhana and is investigating in a correct manner essentially moves at full speed. You know, when you talk about fourth jhanas, it's like top gear. You're in fourth gear, top gear, and you cannot move any. When it comes on the level of samadhi, you just cannot move any faster than that, because each individual has like an optimum speed. You know, they can develop at, because people have different faculties. They have different, qualities, abilities that they've generated in both in the current and past lives on the path, essentially on the Buddhist path. They could have even been previously Christians or even Hindu, you know, because the Christians and Hindus are, and especially the Hindus, are closer to us as far as the teaching than the Christians, and the Christians would come second, and then the Muslims would be third as far as the similarities in teaching, what would you call it, beliefs and observances, religious practice, and you know, kind of cultural attitudes. You know, the Hindus would be close, followed by the Christians, and the Muslims come, because the Muslims believe very, very firmly in a creator God. They're conditioned very, very young to take that on board. Then, while staying at Nalanda in Parvarika's mango grove, the Lord gave a comprehensive discourse to the monks. This is morality, this is stillness, this is wisdom. And having stayed at Nalanda as long as he wished, the Lord said to Ananda, let us go to Pataligama, and they did so. So, as many of you would be aware, you know, when they're talking, let's talk about this business with the jhanas and stillness, you know, what exactly are you stilling? And essentially, you are stilling your personality. You know, your personality structure is what is actually active in the surface level of the mind. You know, it's that which thinks and feels and has views and opinions. It loves, it hates, it likes, it dislikes. You know, it has all sorts of different perspectives and nuances. But essentially, it's that personality complex with thousands and thousands of variations, which is going to stop you from settling down into that very, very profound state of stillness, where you can really start to see very, very clearly what's going on. And some people may argue the point. Like, one gentleman came upstairs many years ago. We were talking about this business, And he said something like, he's a pretty smart guy. I think he was a PhD. He was a university person. I think he was connected with the university department, but he wasn't a lecturer. But he said something along the lines of, he said I perceive on a moment to moment basis, but you know that it's not possible because he's filtering his experience through his personality. So every person in this room has a slightly different take on the ambience and what's actually occurring within within the confines of this space here. The mind states, the kind of feelings you have may vary from person to person. It's not just here; it's the whole course of your day. Your life, which is going to set the tone of your mind state, where you are right at this moment. So until you get that, until you actually tranquilize the personality, you really can't see absolutely crystal clear what's going on around you. Anyone got any opinions on that? Oh, you guys are so easy to work with. And Patigaligama, they heard, the Lord has arrived here, and the lay followers of Patigaligama came to the Lord, saluted him, sat down on one side and said, "May the Lord consent to stay at our rest house." And the Lord consented by silence. Understanding his consent, they rose from their seats, saluted the Lord, and passing him by the right, went to the rest house and strewed the floor, prepared seats, provided a water pot, and filled the oil lamp. Then they went to the Lord, saluting him, stood on one side and said, "All is ready at the rest house, Lord. Now is the time to do as the Lord wished." Now I'll just drop down a little bit. 1.23. Then the Lord addressed the lay followers of Patigaligama. "Householders, there are these five perils to one of bad morality, of failure, immorality." But I mean, what do you people think? Why does a person fail immorality? Why does a person fail in morality? Anyone got any opinions? They don't think it's important. A thought which comes to mind is they don't see the dangers in specific courses of action. So all of us can move in certain directions in life, even on our day-to-day experience. Through the power of intention, we make choices, we move in certain directions, we associate with certain people, we undertake certain activities. And the person who fails in morality is the kind of person who does not see the danger, the cause and effect principle of the conduct they keep. And it's like emotional intelligence. People who have emotional intelligence have enough. They have the. It's like one of the aspects is both internal and peripheral awareness. They have this underlying. It's almost like an intuitive awareness that if I move in a certain direction, if I associate with this certain person, if I start to use maybe particular substances recreationally, I'm going to end up in trouble. Eventually, the person who who's got a very, very small mindset doesn't really think things through, doesn't think about all the possibilities which could occur. That person could potentially go wrong. So you don't have to be an Einstein, you don't have to be intellectually incredibly smart, but if you've got emotional intelligence, you can still live a very good quality lifestyle and still be quite successful in your endeavors.
What are they? In the first place, they suffer great loss of property through neglecting their affairs. In the second place, they get a bad reputation for immorality and misconduct. In the third place, whatever assembly they approach, whether of Kshatriyas, Brahmins or householders or ascetics, he does so diffidently and shyly. I'm not sure about diffidently. In the fourth place, they die confused. Because of pronounced delusion in the mind state of that person. Because of the way that they live their life, they conduct themselves. In the fifth place, after death, at the breaking up of the body, they arise in an evil state, a bad state, in suffering and hell. These are the five perils to one of bad morality. And householders, there are these five advantages to one of good morality and of success morality.
Yep.
Diffidently and shyly. I haven't got my dictionary on me, so. But it's like the person, the feel of it is that, especially this like shyly, the person, they're unsure, they lack confidence, they may feel like self-conscious. You just imagine a person who has a bad reputation. An example came up when I went to, like, you know, I won't give full detail, but I was at Newbury Monastery. And there was a couple there who were quite a pleasant couple. You know, I knew them previously on both sides, the man and his partner. And I won't give you too much detail because you might know them. But they supposedly because of their personal dynamics, they were scrutinized. For choice of words, scrutinized by the Sri Lankan fraternity at, say BSV, I won't give you too much information, by the Sri Lankan community who felt that, you know, their personal standard wasn't, you know, satisfactory and was maybe slightly offensive and this kind of stuff. You could see with the lady that she was watching these people very, very closely, and you could feel the sense that there's like a sense of like sort of say a bit of maybe a little bit of worry, concern, and almost like a slight like a maybe slight threat or slight threat or danger in it. I wouldn't say danger, maybe too strong a word, feeling slightly threatened because you're being judged. Now, you just imagine you walk into a room with your girlfriend, boyfriend, and then, you know, because of circumstances, people, you know, you could have a dozen people, they're looking at you, they're gossiping. Are judging you, and so that may make you feel very, very uncomfortable. So it's a similar category. I'd have to check the dictionary for this diffidently.
Reserved. Reserved in manner? Yep, reserved. And, it's like the person's holding back. You know, you're not absolutely sure. There's not full confidence. You're not projecting yourself fully, you know, in, say, like public, you know, the meetings, congregations.
And householders, there are these five advantages to one of good morality and of success morality. What are they? In the first place, through careful attention to their affairs, they gain much wealth. In the second place, they get a good reputation for morality and good conduct. In the third place, whatever assemblies they approach, whether of Kshatriyas, Brahmins, householders or ascetics, he does so with confidence and assurance. In the fourth place, they die unconfused. In the fifth place, after death, at the breaking up of the body, they arise in a good place, a heavenly world. These are the five advantages to one of good morality and of success in morality. So what I'll do is we've been going for some time. Does anyone want to give any views and opinions on anything whatsoever? Because this is a very, very long sutta. Anything whatsoever? Okay, all right. So, yep. I'll just wait till you get the mic so I can hear you.
Ajahn, what happens when people die confused?
They die confused. So if delusion is quite strong in the mind, it all depends, because the last mind state when it comes down to ten tacks, when the consciousness, those four mental elements which make up mind, the mind. So as you would know, feeling, perception, mental formations and consciousness, like, you know, the thought moments rising up and down. And when a thought moment rises up, that's when a person takes rebirth right at that point. You're looking at, like, minute mind moments. They reckon that there was an analogy by a top-class scholar. There was supposedly, I don't know, I think it was some incredible figure running into hundreds of thousands of mind moments per second. So you're looking at, like, the rise and fall of mind activity incredibly fast. But that last moment is conditioned by the full course of your life and also past lives as well. The current life will be the dominant principle. So that last 60 seconds when you're ready to pass away, the full power of the karma in the current life will be the most significant. So, but if a person's in a state of confusion, confusion in relation to it could be even things like fear of death, or the way they've lived their life, they have doubts, they have worries, concerns. And the mind's not clear. The mind's could be overwhelmed by all sorts of different views, perceptions. The person could be like thinking excessively. There could be excessive worry. The mind's not calm. It's not peaceful. There's no clarity. Lying defilements could be quite active, and the mind is, you know, the person could be, you know, could be quite, what would be the right word, in a state of like anxiety, possibly even fearfulness. And so that would take you essentially, it's not carved in stone, but that last thought moment, said the last, easily the last couple of seconds, will have the most weighty effect on the where you will take rebirth. So as an example, if you died in a complete state of confusion, completely confused, for whatever reason, it could be multiple factors, that you would usually find that those individuals would be reborn as, say, like unhappy beings, unhappy ghosts and spirits who say wander the earth plane. And they live in, you know, they could live in forests, and they won't have a high astral elevation. They won't be like devas and live, say, like in the air. They could live in forest places, forest abandoned places, even like cemeteries, and wherever they were fixated. Like, say for example, a person had an incredible attachment to their that maybe they had a mansion when they died. They're a wealthy person, had a beautiful mansion. They passed away, and that person's spirit may actually hold them to that, you know, that vicinity for, I mean, even for many years, even potentially for 50 years, 100 years, that the spirit, because of the attachment, the spirit is caught and bound there in that location. And that they've had, as many of you would be aware, incidences where as soon as the new owners start to change the decor or rearrange the furnishings, the previous owner becomes very, very unhappy, and then you see an increase in poltergeist activity, and essentially they're letting the new people know they're not happy with the way that they're
they're doing things in their new residence. So, you know, yeah, essentially, so state of confusion, essentially, will take you down below the human realm. But I would say the vast majority of them would be like pretas, unhappy spirits. That would be the main category, because a state of confusion, unless you make incredibly bad karma, you know, where you're killing animals, you know, you're cheating, lying consistently, and in order to take you to hell, it's got to be, you know, I mean, the Buddha gave the impression that it was, one's moral infractions would need to be reasonably like light, but you know, it depends on the mindset of the person. With the monks and nuns, that even with the lay practitioner, if you have someone on eight precepts, when you create an infraction, the karma is actually weightier. Because of the increased, say, sensitivity of the mind, it has the potential to drop you down to the same level, and sometimes lower, because the person on the level of the mind, they have increased awareness, increased understanding, but they still make that big mistake. They know something's wrong, but they just go right ahead without accurate. That's something I'd have to research, but I've heard that previously, you know. But because people's karma is so complicated, you really need incredible psychic ability to know exactly where a person will go. But you know, a confused state, it shouldn't really take them to hell or the realms of the asuras, because they've got a different kind of mentality. You've got to make sort of fairly heavy, fairly weighty karma to be taken down so low. Is there any other opinions at all? Okie doke. We'll call it an afternoon, and I'll catch up with you at some point.